When's our next exam? I just tried to plan.
Not for a while. I think it's after Thanksgiving break.
That's all I need to know.
But you can check it. It's online.
And that's the last one besides the final, right?
Correct. That's my recollection, that the Tuesday after Thanksgiving is a study, is a review day, and then the Thursday is an exam.
Okay. You are a lifesaver.
When is the final?
It's online.
Okay. It's Monday. It's Monday.
She's better than online.
Are both your classes on the same
day? Yes, they're on the same day. They can't be on the same time, right? So I forget, one of them's, you know, in the morning and one of them's in the afternoon. They're pretty close together. So if you have lots of exams at that time, on that day, you can talk to me and we can probably work something out.
Or does it have to be there?
So email me, drop me a line, we can probably work something out. I usually have an alternative time for people to take the exam. I just don't want to have 52 alternative times. So supposedly you had lots of questions, but I haven't. I guess you had questions about when the exam was. Yes.
Okay, so I'm still confused with, do you need to know, it says like if the depth of water in the tube is 5 centimeters, what does that have to do with?
So which
velocity?
Yes. So you're talking about this sedimentation problem, which is, let's just to get everyone on track, what problem number is it? So in 67, they give us a distance that the proteins potentially are going to fall in an hour. And from that, we can get a rate of fall. And if you look at equation 929, it has exactly what we want. That is to say, it gives us the falling velocity of something given the viscosity and the density of the fluid, the density of the protein, and the radius of the fluid. Of the radius of the particle. So the only unknown in that equation will be the radius of the protein. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
So on page 318, equation 9-29. So this is in the section on sedimentation rates. So once you realize that distance and time give you a velocity, it's a plug and chug. More questions?
I don't know if this is necessarily a question or a statement, but some of the end of chapter 9 is pretty ugly. I mean, I'm just saying, like, for me, like, what's a good way to, like, so I tried to review it, try to do some practice problems.
Well, I'm not sure I like the word ugly, because it's all biology, right?
And yeah, but that's not ugly. It's the math that's ugly.
It's the math that's ugly. So let me give a few takes on that. So first of all, here's the review board for this section. And I'm not sure that, so usually I would advertise these as the equations that you would write on your cheat sheet. And I'm not sure that any of these equations are exactly relevant. They all deal with pretty particular situations. And so it's not very general. So I'm sure the purpose of this chapter is to convince you that all this fluid mechanics that you've learned is useful for explaining how biological systems work. But it's all pretty particular as opposed to general. Does that assuage your concerns? Maybe. So let me comment that, like this equation here, I have seen that on MCAT reviews, but it's always been given to, it's not been an equation that the MCAT people expect you to have memorized, because that's a pretty complicated equation. Instead, it's given and then they have you doing some further calculation with it. So it's important to kind of understand the why of this equation, that what we have is a pressure difference that is driving flow, and that viscosity is the limiting factor. The more viscosity you have, the slower the flow is going to be. And also that radius is hugely important because it goes to the fourth. So understanding that equation in particular and being able to apply it, that is something that I've seen on an MCAT test. But it's not, You know, it's not the sort of, it's a plug and chug, right? So it's not a good equation for us to test for. So if I were going to pick out one equation on this board that maybe does belong on your cheat sheet, it would be this general definition of viscosity. The other thing maybe I'll comment about this review board is that I think I've said in the past that the only numbers you needed to know so far were 9.8 meters per second squared. And we're starting to get some material properties that you really should either write on your cheat sheet or know. Like the density of water and that atmospheric pressure is about 10 to the fifth pascals. And today we're going to get this gas constant. Those are things that I would probably give you on an exam, and if I didn't, then you could probably ask me and I would tell you. But and those are things that really belong on a cheat sheet. In contrast to things like these thermal expansion coefficients or Young's modulus, I mean, there are big tables of those sorts of things in CRC, and one would never memorize those numbers. A little bit louder.
Can we go over when we know when it's turbulent or laminar?
So typically, the problem is going to say whether it's turbulent or laminar. Practically speaking, of course, if you looked at the flow, you could tell whether it's turbulent or laminar. I mean, are there little eddies that are swirling around, or does the flow seem to be exactly the same minute by minute by minute? Mm-hmm. If we want to predict whether the flow is turbulent or laminar, then we would use Reynolds number. If the problem is exactly a pipe, then this is the diameter, this is the average speed, this is the density. We're all set to plug into that, and if that number is more than, say, 2,000, then we would expect turbulent flow. But in a more complicated situation, say it's a square pipe as opposed to a round pipe, something like that is going to be true, but exactly where that transition occurs and exactly what formula you're going to use, like are you going to use the side of the square or whatever, those are sort of issues that become engineering issues as opposed to generic problems. So Reynolds number is important because it's always a ratio of the what are called the inertial forces, the forces that lead to turbulence, and the viscous forces that lead to laminar flow. So when the Reynolds number gets large, and exactly what that means is up for grabs, then we're expecting turbulent behavior.
In the top equation, force per area equals
eta, which is viscosity.
Change of V over change of Y is the same as eta? Or is
no, it nope, this is all together. Multiply them together.
For the surface tension, does it say in parentheses under?
Often two sides. If you're thinking about like a soap bubble, then there's air, water, air. So there are actually two surface tensions that are acting on a soap bubble film.
Okay.
I mean, it isn't always that way, but you know, like for example, for the meniscus problem, how high does capillary action act? Then there's just one surface area. There's just one film.
That's R to the fourth in the...
Yes. Yeah. More questions.
Where it says flux equals moles per second over area, is that a D equal to D?
So that D is the diffusion constant, and it's another one of these constants that would depend on the material and the temperature, and you would look that up in the CRC if you really wanted to.
Okay.
So there are a variety of analogous rules where differences with space lead to flows, and Fick's law is just an example of that.
What is the change in C?
So what we're, and incidentally, the book's take on this is slightly different. So I'm thinking about, typically when you're dealing with this in chemistry, the C's are concentrations, moles per liter.
Okay.
The book, I think, talks about this as being grams or something like that. I mean, it doesn't make a big difference, right? Moles, grams, there's a conversion factor.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why I have moles per second here, and I'm thinking of this concentration as being in moles per liter, as opposed to grams, which is how the book has it set up.
So you want us to do it in moles
So repeating what I said, almost certainly I'm never going to use those equations, right?
I was trying to decide if you were reading, so I was listening.
But moles, we're about to, you see that N over there, that famous equation up top that I had assumed that you all were familiar with before you walked into this room.
Which one?
PV equals NRT.
I used to know it.
Used to know it. So moles are about, that N of course is moles, and yes, you should be able to calculate moles from grams and things like that. Which again, that's something that I hope and assume you already know how to do. You've got a question.
Capital R, is that radius?
Yeah, this R here? Yeah, so that's the radius of the pipe. More questions?
So for this chapter, are we most likely going to be tested on viscosity or the stuff we learned before that?
So a good way to figure out what's on the test is what's been on the quiz, and the quiz that wasn't collected but was handed out was Bernoulli's equation. That's by far the most important thing in this book, and kind of the second most important thing would be the buoyant force sort of stuff. I really don't envision testing on that. So I don't envision problem type tests on this sort of material. I can kind of imagine multiple choice questions where you're trying to get an idea of what viscosity is. I suspect there's one around. More questions?
What does that mean under the cosine, next to the cosine? What does that mean again?
Yeah, so here, this idea of the contact angle between, say, water and air and glass, that's determined by an equilibrium of forces. So here we have a surface and a corresponding surface tension between water and air. Here we have a surface tension between water and glass. Here we have a surface tension between air and glass. And that contact angle is totally determined by the relative strength of those forces. So for example, you know that gasoline doesn't form little globs on the surface of water. It stretches out to infinity. And that's because this force, which is the force between water and air, is bigger than these other surface tensions, so it just pulls this thing all the way out to infinity. These guys can't fight this this one.
Okay, so what do those mean?
So these are surface tensions.
The underneath that.
That's a one.
Underneath.
This is an equation. This is the equation that is the equation of force equilibrium, right? So this force plus this component of the force has to equal that force.
What are those fish looking things swimming down? That's what I don't know.
Those are gammas.
Yes.
So why does it say 12, 23, and 13?
Ah, so this is the surface tension between these two materials, which are labeled 1 and 2. This is the surface tension between these two materials, which is 2 and 3. And this is the surface tension between those two guys. So this might be water glass, and this might be water air, and this might be air glass.
And is there any way to know that number?
So you can look up surface tensions in books. They're a little bit tricky because they're highly affected by surface contamination. So even if you looked up what the surface tension is of pure water, it might not apply to water from the tap or water from your distillery. So yes and no. More questions?
Wait, atmospheric pressure is 10 to the 5th Pascals?
Yes. 1.01 if you insist, but 10 to the 5th works fine.
1.01 times 10 to the 5th?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. 1 plus 1/100th times 10 to the 5th is pretty much the same as 1 times 10 to the 5th. More questions? Yeah, so technically atmospheric pressure is 1.01 times 10 to the 5th, but I don't care about that. Okay, so ideal gas law. You all know that, right? Maybe not, huh? Well, so there may be two important things to know about the ideal gas law that I hope you know already. So one is that you can't put in temperature in degrees Celsius here or degrees Fahrenheit. It has to be so-called absolute temperature, where you're measuring temperature above absolute zero. So absolute zero is down 273 degrees on the Celsius scale. So to get absolute temperature, which is measured in K, Kelvin, you need to add 273 to the temperature in degrees Celsius. So K is equal to degrees C plus 273, and if you really insist on lots of significant digits, 0.15. The same thing applies to pressures, right? You remember that typically when we measure like the pressure on our tires, we're measuring gauge pressure, and so we have to remember to add in atmospheric pressure to get the total pressure. But otherwise, this is, I hope, a pretty straightforward equation, right? This is pressure, this is volume, this is the number of moles. R is a universal constant that you should probably write on your cheat sheets. 8.31 joules per Kelvin, and T is the temperature in Kelvin. So I hope you all know how to calculate moles, right? So we need the gram molecular weight. Yes?
What is the R? What is there a name for that?
The gas constant. And of course, depending upon the units you use, you're going to get different numbers for the gas constant. So back in old chemistry, people used atmospheres and liters, and so I have kind of a funny number as opposed to 8.31. So, for example, for carbon dioxide, carbon has a molecular weight of 12, and oxygen has a molecular weight of
16.01.
16 is close enough for me. So the gram molecular weight, I just add up the weights of all of those things, and that would tell me how many grams are in a mole. And a mole is close enough to 6 times 10 to the 23rd of objects. Now, literally, this equation is often not used in this form because very commonly you have problems where the number of moles and, of course, the gas constant aren't changing. So that PV over T, that's the same under all situations. So it's kind of like Bernoulli's equation. We can calculate PV over T under one situation, and we can calculate PV over T in another situation, and we have to get exactly the same result. Most commonly, you set things up so that, say, you're interested in the pressure on a new situation where you've changed the volume and temperature of the result. And if you just see what happens when you rearrange this equation, we get the ratio of temperatures, we get the ratio of volumes, and we get the original pressure. So you can almost, without thinking, set up the answers to these problems by just thinking to yourself, if I make this change in temperature, what's it going to do to the pressure? Does the big number go in the numerator or the denominator? Or if you want, you can just use PV equals nRT as a fixed number. Okay. Gas constant, you must have worked lots of these problems in your life. No.
Not really.
A misspent youth.
Sorry.
Yes, there's nothing else
that
pressure
needs to be in ATM.
Say again?
Pressure needs to be in what?
So we like pressure in pascals. So, I don't know, let's take a look at one of these kind of sample problems. So we like to measure pressure in pascals and volume in cubic meters and temperature in degrees Kelvin and number of moles in number of moles, and then R is 8.31, the corresponding constant. So 30 is a fairly complicated problem that adjusts everything. So I don't know if it's a good place to start or a bad place to start. But here we've got a 20-liter tank of carbon dioxide that's under a pressure that is about 9.5 atmospheres, and it's at a temperature that is 19 Celsius, and we know we're going to have to change that to Kelvin. In fact, that's the first part of the problem. What they say is that a fire breaks out and the temperature is raised by 224 degrees Kelvin. Meanwhile, 82 grams of gas leak out, and we're supposed to calculate what the pressure is after all of this happens. Okay, so we got lots of things changing. So in order to calculate the temperature, of course, I hope that's pretty easy. The temperature under the original situation is the temperature in degrees Celsius plus the 273. So that's 292 K. The initial volume, we're told it's 20 liters. And I don't know how you remember what a liter is, but there are, in 1 liter, there are 1,000 milliliters, that is to say 1,000 cubic centimeters. And of course, in a there are 100 centimeters in a meter. And I need to cube that. So I've got 1,000 upstairs and I've got 100 cubed downstairs. 100 cubed is a million. So what I've got is 20 divided by 1,000, and in terms of units, cubic meters. Right? So the initial volume is 0.02 of a cubic meter. And we have, they tell us what the original pressure is, 9.5 times 10 to the fifth. So we're all set then to calculate the number of moles. Right? So the number of moles is going to be P1V1 divided by RT1. So we have 9.5 times 10 to the fifth, and we've got 0.02, and we've got 8.31 for R, and we've got a temperature of 292. 9.5 and exponent 5, 0.02 times that, 8.31. And 292, that leads to 7.83 moles. Yes?
So the pressure, did you have to add the atmospheric pressure to the 9.5?
So I guess it's a little bit ambiguous. They've just said what the pressure is. Almost certainly, if you if there was a meter on this tank, it would read gauged pressure. But I think from the context, we're supposed, since they didn't tell us what atmospheric pressure is, I think we're supposed to assume that this is an absolute pressure. So problem isn't perfectly clear, and it would be nice if they all, instead of saying the word pressure, they said gauge pressure or absolute pressure. If you're, I repeat, if there are typically gauges on tanks and they read gauge pressure. So in some sense, you should suspect that this is a gauge pressure. But if something is a, no, so gauge pressure means it hasn't been done.
Okay.
So this is a little bit weird. For my problems, if it is a gauge pressure, I will say pressure. I will try and remember to say absolute pressure if it's an absolute pressure. But if I just say pressure, I mean absolute pressure.
If you were to happen to give us the absolute or the atmospheric pressure, then would we maybe assume too, like if we're not
Well, so I would say ask, right? So I have promised you, and I would have to grade it that way too. So I have formally promised you that if I say that the only circumstance where I mean gauge pressure is when I have the words exactly gauge pressure.
Okay.
Well, the book's different in this case because you're supposed to imply that there's a gauge on the tank.
I don't think so. So I'm pretty sure that the book is assuming that's an absolute pressure. I have worked it as if that's an absolute pressure.
Okay.
I think the book will follow that same procedure, that they will remind you about gauge pressure by including the word gauge.
Okay.
More questions? Okay, so we're supposed to subtract off 82 grams, right? And of course, we have to convert that 82 grams into moles. And we've just calculated, well, I guess we didn't calculate, we didn't do the addition. Apparently, there are 44 grams per mole. For carbon dioxide, so we've got 82 divided by 44, and that's 1.86 moles. So what I have left over then is 5.97 moles. Okay, so now the new temperature is the old temperature, 292 plus 224. So I got 292 and 224. So it's 516. The volume is unchanged. And we now have a new number of moles, and they're asking us to calculate the pressure. So PV equals nRT, so P is nRT divided by the volume. So I've got my new number of moles, 5.97. I've got my gas constant, 8.31. I've got my new temperature of 516. And I've got my same old volume of 0.02. And I get 1.28 times 10 to the 6 pascals. Let's check our units. So this was moles. The units of gas constant are joules per mole degree Kelvin. This is Kelvin. And then I divided this all by cubic meters. So the moles go away and the k's go away. And I have joules per meter cubed. Remember that a joule is a Newton meter. So I get newtons per meter squared, which is exactly what a pascal is. Okay. So you know that helium has a low density. That's why helium balloons float. You might remember that the density of air was about 1.3 kilograms per cubic meter, and here it's roughly a tenth of that. And that goes along with the molar weight of helium being roughly a tenth of what it is for air. So we have this density at freezing point. At boiling point, we're expecting a lower density because things are going to expand. And we're supposed to calculate this new density of helium. So the equations we've written down haven't involved density, right? They've been P1 V1 over T1 is P2 V2 over T2, assuming that we have the same number of things. Now remember, though, that density is the mass divided by the volume. And of course, it's the same mass inside the balloon. So the mass is a constant. It's just the volume that's going to change. We're going to have an enlarged volume, so we're going to have a reduced density. So first of all, in terms of this problem, the pressure is the same. So the enlarged volume is going to be the original volume. And since the temperature went up, I'm expecting to have that ratio, the higher temperature over the lower temperature. So if I plug that in for the new density, I have a mass divided by that V2. Mass over volume is density. That's the original density. And if I flip that upside down, I get that. And again, you could have actually come to this immediate conclusion just by recognizing that with this ideal gas law, you're going to end up with ratios of equivalent things. And if we heat something up, we expect the bigger number to go on the bottom so that we get a reduced density. Good to go?
That's density one, not
the... Yes, yeah. So everything's are now densities. Yes? So all I did is plug in for V2.
Okay. And then because M over V1 or V is density. Okay.
So in terms of numbers, we've got the original density that is 0.179. The 0 degrees, obviously, we're not going to plug in 0. We're going to add 273 to make that absolute temperature. We're going to add 273 to the bottom. So we can plug and chug and get what the density, even lower density of hot helium is compared to And of course, one of the advantages of dealing with ratios is that the unit should be clear, right? Whatever units we had here, that's what we're going to have for units in the end.
What happens to the M over V that should
circle? So I used right here. Mass per volume is density. More questions? Okay, so we've got ideal gas law problems. We also have problems that deal with unit conversion. So here's kind of a straightforward problem where they're asking us to convert temperatures in Fahrenheit to Kelvin, Celsius, off we go to the races. So they're saying that a high temperature is 134 degrees Fahrenheit and a cold temperature is basically minus 80 degrees Fahrenheit. Do the conversion. So I don't know, my favorite way of converting Fahrenheit and Celsius is to use the equation that 5F minus 9C is 160 as opposed to separate equations. So whatever one's missing, I can just solve for that variable. In this particular circumstance, they're asking us for C, so if I just rearrange things, I've got 5F minus 160 is 9C. So C is going to be 5F minus 160 all over 9. So for the hot temperature, this is going to be 5 times 134 minus 160 all divided by 9. So, I don't know, go ahead. The temperature in degrees Celsius.
Oh.
So kind of ballparking it, you know, 100, so you know that boiling point of water in Fahrenheit is 212 and freezing point is 32. So we're kind of halfway, roughly speaking, to the boiling point at 134. Boiling point of water in Celsius is 100, freezing point is 0. So we're ballparking an answer that's going to be kind of like 50.
That's going to hold.
Yes.
So we don't have to use the other equations. Okay.
Yep, that's one equation as opposed to two. It's the only equation I know. Okay, so 5 times 134, and then subtract off 160 and divide that all by 9, and I get 56.7 degrees Celsius. So one famous temperature is 98.6, right? So what is 98.6 in Celsius? What's 98.6 in Celsius?
Kelvin?
Celsius.
98.6 Kelvin?
No. Okay. So 98.6 is famous for body temperature, right?
Yeah.
You're sick if it's above that. And that's degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh, yeah. So I need to convert 98.6 to Celsius.
Yes.
I don't remember.
Wait. It's a number that you really almost, if you're a biologist, you should pretty much know.
I used to know it.
Me too.
You too.
Yeah, me too.
37. 37C. There's kind of another standard temperature. At what temperature is degrees Fahrenheit the same as the degrees Celsius?
Minus 30? No, minus 40.
It's minus 40. Yeah, it's exactly minus 40. So it's, and minus 40 Fahrenheit is the same, is the coldest it's ever been here in Collegeville since I've been here. So. Minus 40.
When did it get that cold?
It's a long time ago. I can't remember, but it did.
Are you talking just air temperature? Or you include
winter?
No, air temperature. Real temperature, not fake temperature.
That's what I figured.
So in the last class, I asked what the coldest temperature anyone experienced, and they had said minus 47. And so they had me beat. Camping in the Boundary Waters in winter. Pretty believable.
It's a lot of fun.
Did you stay inside?
I went outside. Yeah. A chance to experience minus 40. Not to be missed.
I've had it where you can like spit bumps this
month. Yeah, it wasn't that cold. So we got two other equations to deal with here. So these equations deal with how kind of old-fashioned thermometers work. So if you look at an old-fashioned mercury thermometer, it consists of a ball of mercury and then a little capillary. And what happens, of course, as the temperature changes, the mercury expands, and it doesn't expand much, but this is a very narrow capillary, so the mercury rises in the capillary. The higher the temperature, the higher the column goes, so all we have to do is put some calibrated marks on the side, and we can figure out what the temperature is. So that's volume expansion, and the fudge factor that you could look up in CRC, different for every material, which our book calls beta, the volume expansion coefficient. Also, things expand linearly. So if I have a rod and I heat it up, it's going to be bigger. So you've all seen expansion joints on bridges that are designed to deal with the fact that the length of the bridge is going to change with temperature. So I don't know, one kind of standard example, if you have something with a hole and I heat it up, does this kind of heat up all directions so that the hole gets smaller, or does the hole get bigger when you heat it up?
Bigger.
So I don't have to test it. If you already know the answer, there's no reason to. I haven't really figured out how to use this.
You want a different lighter?
It worked for the earlier class, and I'll faint, and then we don't have to worry about it anymore.
No.
There we go. So currently, no go. If I heat this up enough, nothing much happens in class and everyone goes to sleep, and then I can claim that it fits just fine.
Whoa. Right? You should chop it in now.
Still hot enough. So another kind of standard way of measuring temperature is to take a bimetallic strip. So you take two materials that have different linear expansion coefficients. So let's say that this is copper and this is iron.
Is the symbol right next to the delta, is that the linear?
So this is the linear expansion coefficient as the symbol alpha, and this is the volume expansion coefficient, which is beta. And the book talks about an area expansion coefficient, but I've never had any use for the area expansion coefficient, so it's not going to be on my review board. So if, let's say that iron expands more than copper, so the only way it can expand is if it goes in a circle that has a larger circumference than the copper. So a straight piece of metal will bend, and this is a lot of how, so currently this thing is straight. That's the way a lot of household thermostats work. The piece of metal bends and it makes an electrical contact, which then turns on the furnace. And I can see that this is bending, but it's a dramatic effect that you don't need to see. I mean, it's starting to get there, right?
So they're like pasted together and one pulls the other.
Yeah, so they're pasted together, pounded together, really, and then in order for the one that expands more to expand more, it has to be the outer circumference. And even though the actual length expansion, that alpha coefficient is always very small, so obviously the outer circumference isn't that much more than the inner circumference, so we've magnified that very small difference in linear change by having it bend as opposed to go the other way. Okay, so a couple or three problems on that. So kind of the most straightforward one is this 124. So we have a pipeline that is 1,000 kilometers long. It's in Alaska, so it's subject to pretty big temperature changes, and we're supposed to figure out how much length is going to change for this pipeline. So this is made out of steel, so we have to go look up in the book what the thermal expansion coefficient is of steel. Not something that's particularly memorable, but according to my notes, it's 11 times 10 to the minus sixth. And the units of that are 1 over degrees Celsius or degrees Kelvin. It's the same thing. So what I'm supposed to do is to multiply alpha times the temperature change, and the temperature goes between 35 and minus a minus 73. And that's going to give me the change in length. So if I multiply it by L, I should be good to go. So L is the 1,300 kilometers. And here's my calculator. So I've got 35 minus a minus 73 is my temperature change. And I've got 11 inner exponent change sine to the minus sixth, excuse me. And I've got a length that is 1,300 kilometers. And I get a change in length of about 1.5 kilometers, which is pretty much a mile. So we have to have big expansion joints. And there's a picture in the front of chapter 10 that shows the sort of expansion joints that are necessary to deal with these changes in length. So here's a similar problem with volume expansions. So we've got a 50-gallon container of carbon tetrachloride, and they tell us what the volume expansion coefficient is for carbon tet, and it's going to go from 10 degrees to 30 degrees, and the question is how much carbon tet is going to fall on the floor. Who gets to pick up the carbon tet? Take it you all know that carbon tetrachloride is not a nice chemical. Sure. You should not have played with it in your youth like I did. Well, we had a bottle of carbon tet around.
What happened?
You see what happened.
You got white hair.
You want to look like this? Okay, so so the change in volume is the volume times beta times the change in temperature. The volume is 50 gallons, and the beta, they tell us, is 5.81 times 10 to the minus 4th. And the units are per degree Celsius. And we underwent a temperature change that was 20 degrees Celsius. Notice that the degrees Celsius are going to cancel out. So the only units that we're going to have are the gallons that we put in originally. So we've got 5.81, 10 to the minus 4th, 20 degree change, 50 gallons. And what we get is 0.58 gallons. That's the change in temperature.
Okay.
And we went 30, 10, so the change in temperature is 20 degrees.
And is that 1 over degrees Celsius?
That's the units of thermal expansion.
Oh.
Yep, see?
Oh, inverse Kelvin, okay.
And it could just as well be Kelvin, because the size of a degree Celsius is the same as the size of a degree Kelvin. They're just offset by that 273. Okay, so 0.6 gallons, that's more than 2 liters of carbon tet on the floor. Right?
Carbon tet's like super strong.
No. So
I know we've used it, I just can't remember.
I bet you haven't used it. I bet you haven't. I bet that if there is...
In our someplace, OCAM, we've talked about it.
Maybe you've talked about it. So it used to be a common cleaning fluid. So, you look at the chemistry, right? It's going to have those inert chlorine bonds, so it's a fairly inert, like benzene. It's good for removing oils and things like that. It used to be commonly used. It's a carcinogen. So my mom had a little bottle of it that she would use to get out oil out of clothes. And now it's locked up.
And it didn't stay, or didn't like take color or stain the shirts or anything? It just took the oil out?
You're going to want some, huh?
Well, I don't know. I'm surprised the danger is, and it didn't do anything to the clothes.
Look at the chemical structure. It's pretty inert.
Yeah.
It's not going to have any sort of chemical reaction. It's not an acid. It's like benzene, right? Well, I guess benzene is another of these things that you don't play with anymore. We also had a little container of benzene right next to it. Different times. And I also had my own little home chemistry set, of course, which had all sorts of chemicals that I could use to poison my teachers. Pile of dead bodies through sixth grade. So here's a kind of common use of the combination of Young's modulus and linear expansion. So what we're going to do is we're going to take this band and heat it up not a whole lot, so this is less than the boiling point of water, and slip it on this tooth, and when it cools down, it's going to shrink, and it's going to provide quite noticeable forces around this band. So we heat it up to expand it, we slip it on the tooth. When it goes to normal temperature, it's now overextended by that same amount. And according to Young's modulus, if you've stretched something, there's going to be a corresponding force. And you can get pretty big forces by this simple procedure. To make a nice physics problem. What better reason would you want? Physics is always comes first. Okay, so what we've got is our Young's modulus equation, that the change in length is going to be given by the force per area per Young's modulus. And let's be clear about what area we're talking about. So here's in cross section what that band looks like. And it's this area we're talking about. So this area that has a thickness that is half a millimeter, and this height that is 4 millimeters. Right? So that's the area that's going to go into our Young's modulus formula. On the other hand, we also know that the change in length is given by the linear expansion coefficient times the change in temperature. So the length that we're talking about would be the circumference of this tooth, but notice it doesn't enter into the formula. Right? The change in L over L is common to both of those results. Okay, so they're asking us for the force, so we have to rearrange things. The y comes up, the a comes up. So we have y times the area times alpha times delta t. That's equal to the force that this this band is constraining. So they tell, this is stainless steel, and they tell us the linear expansion coefficient is 17.3 times 10 to the minus 6th. Notice the units are 1 over degrees Celsius, and the Young's modulus is 18 times 10 to the 10th. 10 to the 10th is huge. So 17.3 times 10 to the minus 6th is alpha, and y is 18 times 10 to the 10th newtons per square meter. We've already said that the area is this 4 millimeters by 0.5 millimeters, and the change in temperature is the 80 minus the 37. So this is a hugely small cross-sectional area, right? Millimeters times millimeters is going to give us 10 to the minus 6 square meters. So that's going to be very small. This is pretty small, but 10 to the 10th is huge. So we're going to get out kind of moderate forces out from this pretty moderate change in temperature. Okay, so we've got the 80 and the 37. Might as well start with the change in temperature of 43 degrees. We've got our alpha that is 17.3 and our exponent change sign 6. And we've got a Young's modulus that is 18 and our exponent 10. And we've got an area that is 0.5 times 10 to the minus 3 times 4 times 10 to the minus 3. And we get a force that is 268 newtons. And we can check our units out. Of course, the degrees Celsius cancel out top and bottom. The area in square meters is going to cancel the square meters in our Young's modulus, so we're going to get newtons out in the end. Okay, so a couple of simple equations that involve expansion and ideal gas law, which I hope you've seen lots of times before. Questions on any of that? Okay, so how about some iQuiz questions? So we double the temperature. We go from 30 degrees Celsius to 60 degrees Celsius for the same volume. How does the pressure change? So we double the temperature, how does the pressure change? Aha, not fooled, huh? Correct, or I think that's correct. Not correct, fooled, not fooled. Okay, so this story of doubling the temperature, that was the lie, right? The Celsius temperature was doubled, you know, like going from 1 degree to 2 degrees Celsius, that would double the temperature. But that's not doubling the absolute temperature. So when you increase the temperature, other things being constant, the pressure is going to increase. And if the temperature did double, the pressure would double. But the temperature only increased from basically 300 to 330. It only increased by about 10%. So the pressure is going to increase by about 10%, but by less than double.
And wait, why are we thinking that it by only 10%?
Because what matters is absolute temperature. So I'm going from 30 plus 273, which is 303, to 60 plus 273, which is 333. And that's a 10% increase in absolute temperature. So I hope it's clear that I can double the temperature, go from 1 degree to 2 degrees, and, you know, big yawn, right? It's not going to do much. So it's absolute temperature that counts. So we got two identical rooms connected by an open doorway. The rooms are identical, meaning they have the same volume. Which room contains the most air? I'm fooling a few people. So the pressure and volume is the same. The only thing that's different is the temperature. And according to this equation, PV over RT gives us the number of moles. So the higher the temperature, the fewer the moles, the less amount of air that you have. So the lower temperature room is going to have more air. Now let's skip over the first one. So, which of those temperatures is the warmest? I'm fooling some, but not many. So 10 degrees Fahrenheit is below freezing, right? Whereas 10 degrees Celsius is above freezing. 10 degrees Kelvin is a little bit above liquid helium temperature. And 250 is still pretty cold by Kelvin standards, right? So the warmest is C, is A, right? 10 degrees Celsius. How about temperature changes? Which of the following is the largest temperature change? That's what I mean by amount of cooling. Yeah, it's a two-handed answer. So there are basically 200 Fahrenheit degrees between freezing and boiling, where there are only 100 Celsius degrees. So Celsius degrees are bigger than Fahrenheit degrees. But of course, they're exactly the same size as Kelvin. So it's a two-handed A and B sort of answer. Or, yeah. So which one has more heat, Lake Superior or Moi? Which has more heat? Lake Superior, cold, distant Lake Superior, or Moi?
Hey.
That's a cold statement to make. Yeah, so heat is an extensive variable, right? So Lake Superior is huge. It doesn't have a lot of energy per cc, but there's a lot of cc's, right? So extensive variables, if you've got more of something, you've got more. Which is hotter? Right. Maybe that's not the best word. So maybe less ambiguously, which has a higher temperature? Yeah, so temperature is an intrinsic variable. It's like density. More cold water doesn't make you any colder. doesn't change the temperature, it just changes the amount of heat that you've got. So this one is maybe a little bit premature, but I think you've all seen these things. So these are these cold packs. So you punch these cold packs and they get cold. So how do they work? I'm fooling some, but one in particular, at least. So no, I don't think anyone picked A, right? Oh! Punching a bag of chemicals isn't going to do much of anything to the chemicals, so. And I hope that you know that cold isn't something that's produced, right? So there is energy, and there's an absence of energy, but there isn't cold as a substance. So the cold pack forcibly expelled heat. I don't know how it forced it out, maybe with pitchforks or something, which lowered the temperature. Well, if you could expel the heat, that would reduce the temperature, but what happened to that heat? So I like D. If you have heat, you have energy, and that energy has to go someplace, right? Energy conservation, and what it goes to is forming new chemical bonds. So it went from thermal energy to potential energy of chemical bonds, and as a result, there was less thermal energy.
So the two chemicals will react with each other, they're just not touching, right?
So there are lots of ways, so let me not say how those particular devices work, but maybe at least remind you or remind myself of a chemical experiment we did in Gen Chem 1, where you mix together two chemicals and you make cold, right? So yeah, so by creating these bonds, we're eating up some of the thermal energy and to create those bonds, so there's less thermal energy available. And we'll learn eventually that the only way you can have a spontaneous reaction like that that has a negative Q that's eating up thermal energy is if there's a big increase in entropy as a result. Because delta G has to be negative, right?
Have you seen one of those like hot packs that like you boil it for a while and then you like snap the catalyst in it and it makes this like solid block that's really hot? It's normally liquid, but like you see it crystallizes.
So I think we might have that as a demo down there, but I haven't played with it. So those are phase change devices. So this is a chapter ahead of where we are, right? So Q equals MC delta T, that's another thing I'm kind of assuming that you've all done in chemistry. Foreign language? Specific heat?
Sounds familiar.
Sounds... So, from the distant past. So, there's one last problem that I skipped over. So, this has to do with that section of the book that deals with surface volume ratios. So, the monster movie where we have the giant ants, right, it doesn't work out, right? You can't make ants that are big because they wouldn't be able to breathe. We need small microorganisms so that they have a lot of surface area. So, which has more skin area? We have a kilogram of stuff. It's all made mostly of water, so that's the same volume. So a kilogram of grapes has more skin area than two-handed answer, right? The smaller object has a bigger surface volume area ratio. Right, because the surface area of a sphere goes like 4 pi r squared, and the volume goes like r cubed. So the smaller the radius, the bigger the surface volume ratio. So the easier it is to breathe for a microorganism. It has a lot more surface area for interior stuff. Okay. It's a two-handed answer, B and C. So, I can't remember if we talked about this at the beginning of class or not. Lots of people having trouble registering. I don't know if you were in that ballpark. It's not a trivial problem. So I want to say two things. In my experience, these problems are always resolved. So there will be an answer. But it turns out it's going to be a fairly complicated answer. There are on the order of 20 people who have problems. So don't expect a solution, you know, today or tomorrow. The registrar have to work out how to change things around so that people can fit in classes. Because currently, I think all of the 106 classes are full.
All of them are?
I think so, or at least mostly full.
Right. Well, there's only one of them that works.
Yeah, so lots of people have a chemistry class that conflicts with the 1120 class. So it's actually a long time to a quiz too. I'd have to check, but it's not coming up immediately. Is it that soon? I don't think so. So maybe it's an MC delta T quiz, calorimetry. I like you to quibble, because I quibble all the time. It's fair. So what do you quibble?